Deutsche Welle, Spotlight on Europe.
A very warm welcome to this edition of Spotlight on Europe, coming to you from our studios in Bonn, Germany. My name is Pora Nyambura. If you're listening to this for the first time, it's Deutsche Welle's new program on Europe from an African perspective. Well, let's get right down to business. Coming up over the next half hour, Manchester grieves as police make more arrests in connection to Monday's bomb attack.
Mancunians and Manchester has always been a city based on people standing together and not being divided. And we will not allow terrorism to divide us, which is why we brought our three children with us today.
Noisy protesters greet Donald Trump in Brussels. And if you thought coups were only common to Africa, then you were wrong. Turkey is no stranger to them either, and the after effects of last July's coup are still being felt in the country. Stick around for these stories and more in this edition of Spotlight on Europe. Islamist groups have caused millions of deaths across Africa. Al-Shabaab, a Somali jihadist group, is active in East Africa, Al-Qaeda in North Africa, and of course, the well-known Boko Haram in West Africa. Their impact is spreading far and wide, and not just in Africa. Manchester, in the UK, is the latest casualty of extremists following a suicide bomb attack that left 19 dead and 50 injured. The British police and security services are continuing to map the network they suspect supported Salmani Abedi in his suicide terrorist attack in Manchester on Monday. Meanwhile, the city itself is trying to move on. So, how will these attacks affect Manchester, a city known for its inclusion and tolerance? This report from Lash Bevanga in Manchester starts with some of those who escaped the attack at the Manchester Arena.
The concert had finished and we were just about to go out, and then we just heard a huge bang and we were like, what is that? I thought it was a gunshot, but then my mum was saying that must be a bomb.
Cherry is 10 years old and she'd just watched her hero Ariana Grande in concert together with her mother Chloe Naiman and stepsister when childish joy turned to horror.
I screamed and it was just really, really scary.
And as we were running up towards our hotel, there was two young girls, and I noticed they had no parents and they were screaming. So I grabbed hold of them and I said, look, I know you've got no parents, just come to our hotel and I'll make sure we find them.
Early the next morning, Chloe managed to reunite the girls with their parents. For many others, that was not to be the case.
I'm just trying to get into work now. I had to park about a mile away, but...
Stephen White was one of the many Mancunians working near the Manchester Arena who had to walk to the office the next day as police had closed off large areas of the city.
It's a horrible tragedy, a horrible... I've seen all the teenagers going to the concert last night, so my office is just behind the building, and everyone parks near our office, and it was a great atmosphere last night, all the young people, and crazy. I've got to get to work now and open
That's
up.
That's fine.
As forensic teams were still sifting through the debris, the people of Manchester were getting on with their lives with quiet determination. Yet nothing felt ordinary the day after the bomb. The city was still on edge.
So I was just inside the Arndale Centre, the main shopping centre in Manchester city centre, had just been evacuated. People started running. I ran too, and we've been told by police now to move on up the street outside in a calm fashion. Nobody knows what's going on right now.
That turned out to be a false alarm, but with armed police on the streets and later the prospect of soldiers guarding key sites and events being cancelled, the free spirit and optimism of Manchester had clearly been curtailed. But the famous Manchester spirit, a sense of community running across ethnicities and religions, was out in full force that same evening as thousands gathered to attend a vigil in front of the town hall in memory of the victims.
Well, there's spontaneous applause here in Albert Square as a group of Sikh men are marching in to attend tonight's vigil. And this is a clear sign of people's desire to keep this city a multicultural and accepting place, and that terror is not going to change anything here in Manchester.
Among the crowd was Abid Hussain.
I'm showing my solidarity with the all the victims of the disaster that happened yesterday, whether they be Muslim, Christian, Jew, and I'd like to make a solid declaration that this has got nothing to do with Islam.
Just hours earlier, the identity of the bomber had been made public, a Manchester-born 22-year-old man of Libyan descent. So-called Islamic State had claimed responsibility for the atrocity, but the anti-Islam backlash, feared by some, didn't materialise. Instead, the people of Manchester came together in unity against the terror.
Mancunians and Manchester has always been a city based on people standing together and not being divided.
Mark Beattie had brought his three young daughters with him to the vigil to show them what Mancunians are made of.
And we will not allow terrorism to divide us, which is why we brought our three children with us today.
And do you believe that that is what's going to happen? Is this going to bring the city even more closely together?
I think that's the, by and large, the main effect will be bringing people together. Of course, there will be isolated occasions where it stokes up hatred and division, but we need to try and stand together to avoid that.
So many families and friends are only just starting to come to terms with their loss. Meanwhile, the city of Manchester looks as if it's dusting itself off and getting ready to move on. Questions still will remain around how a young individual could be radicalised to the extent of deciding to attack children and young people in the very city he himself grew up in. And as people keep bringing flowers to the square here in front of the Manchester Town Hall, the consensus seems to be that the responsibility for his actions were his and those of any fellow perpetrators and cannot be laid on the shoulders of any one community. For the security services here and elsewhere, the question remains, how do you stop terror on the streets of Europe when it is carried out by individuals who live there? Lars Bevanger, DW, Manchester.
And just 2 days after the Manchester attack, 20 people were killed on Wednesday by a bomb in northern Kenya. The government has since deployed the military to beef up security against the Al-Shabaab. At least 34 countries in Africa have experienced coup attempts, never mind that most of them have been unsuccessful. That is at least half of the countries on the continent, not to mention my home country Kenya in 1982. But just like what happened in Turkey last year, Kenya's coup attempt failed too. In Turkey, the aftermath of the coup is still being felt. More than 220 suspects went on trial on Monday, accused of plotting last year's July coup attempt. Deutsche Welle's Turkey correspondent Dorian Jones tells Helen Sini more about the opening of the trial.
Well, many of those accused were walked by crowds of protesters against the coup, many of them shouting that they wanted the death penalty, death to the generals, many chanted. It was a very acrimonious atmosphere. And in the first day of hearings, we've been hearing that all of those accused are denying any involvement, including one of the most senior generals. He said that he was falsely accused. Others have claimed that confessions extracted from them was done under duress, even torture. One person claimed that he was so badly beaten that many people felt that he would die from his injuries. This trial is extremely high profile, very important for the president and government in their stand against what they say is this ongoing threat of coup plotters.
If they are found guilty, they could face life imprisonment. And President Erdogan has also spoken of reintroducing the death penalty. Is that likely, do you think?
Very difficult to say. Throughout the last month's referendum, it was a key part of the President Erdogan's campaign. He said that if he achieved success in the referendum, priority for him would be the returning of the death penalty. He even said there would be another referendum on this. But interestingly, since then, he's been remarkably quiet on the return of the death penalty. I think much of this will be tied to seeing how his relations with, and particularly Europe, develop. If they do continue to remain strained or even start to fall apart, then we could well see the death penalty coming back. If they do start to show some signs of progress, then it's unlikely that there will be a return of the death penalty, because everyone knows if the death penalty is returned, it's the end of Turkey's EU relationships.
Dorian, are there questions being asked about how fair this trial will be?
Well, definitely. I mean, the Turkey's judicial system is very much under scrutiny for lack of independence, the fact that Turkey is under emergency rule, the fact that thousands of judges and prosecutors have been removed by these emergency powers, and there is a great deal of concern that there isn't very little independence left in the judiciary, and also that we are starting to hear from those accused of claiming that they were abused and tortured. This is a concern that's been echoed by international human rights groups as well. Will again cast a shadow over the veracity of this court case, but it has to be said this country, like everything else, is split down the middle. Those who back the government dismiss such concerns, and those who are critical are voicing increasing concerns over the judicial process.
Well, on the same day that the trial opened, Amnesty International published a report criticising the government for its arbitrary dismissal of public sector workers since the failed coup. Is this purge continuing?
Oh, certainly is. In the last few days, we've seen over several hundred people dismissed from local municipalities, including the capital Ankara. Many of those have also been arrested. The purges continue unabated. In fact, if anything, they've accelerated since last month's referendum. We've seen thousands more people dismissed from the universities, schools, all across Turkish society. It's now estimated to be over 140,000 people have lost their jobs. And the president, speaking at his Congress, where he was reappointed as leader, he warned that there'll be no let up in this ongoing purge. He says the country still faces the threat of the danger posed by this Islamic cleric, Fethullah Gulen, who was blamed as the mastermind for July's failed coup attempt. He's accused of having a network of followers that have infiltrated large parts of the state. And the president says he's determined to remove that threat from Turkish society. So no one is expecting any let up in these ongoing purges of civil workers.
In a related development, a teacher and an academic who have been on hunger strike since being sacked have now been arrested. Was that because they'd become a focus of opposition to the government?
Very much so. Semih Ozakçu and Nuriyer Gülmen have become this focal point of concern over this ongoing mass purges. One was a teacher and one is a professor, accused of being followers of this Islamic cleric Fethullah Gulen. They hotly disputed these claims and they went on hunger strike. Now they're in nearly 80 days now on a fast of just water and sugar, but they have become this focal point. The fact that they are seen as apolitical, even people from the conservative side of Turkish society, along with leftist liberals, are focusing on these two people. And I think that is why that they have been detained. They have been now accused of being members of an extreme left-wing organization, which runs contrary to the reason they were removed from their jobs in the first place, accused of being supporters of an Islamic cleric. So again, it raises concerns over the judiciary and the way it's operating. And I think that now that they've been detained, there's increasing pressure growing in the country. There are protests in many cities and towns, immediately being crushed by the police, but there is this growing unrest. And you see graffiti on all over Istanbul expressing support for these two educators, and the fate of those in many ways, and I think the fear of the president, the government, is they could become this nationwide focal point of unrest and concern over this ongoing crackdown.
That was Deutsche Welle's Turkey correspondent Dorian Jones talking to Helen Sini. Over 6,000 people took to the streets to protest as US President Donald Trump arrived in Brussels on Thursday to attend his first meeting of NATO, an alliance he once threatened to abandon. Though NATO had polished up the choreography for a picture-perfect meeting between President Trump and his European allies, things were not like that outside. As Terry Schultz reports, activists took to the streets of Brussels to make clear they were not happy about Trump's visit.
It's a tale of two sides of one city, a city Donald Trump labeled a hellhole on the campaign trail. On one side of Brussels, at NATO headquarters, the utmost care was being given to make sure, as one ambassador put it, nothing gets mucked up in the few hours President Trump would be present. Meanwhile, in the heart of Brussels, thousands of people turned out to make sure his stay was marked by the message that he was not welcome.
Let's go. Hey, hey. Whoa, whoa. Donald Trump has got to go. Hey, hey.
The Trump Not Welcome movement was launched on the campus of Ghent University months ago by a handful of students who expected to be able to gather a few hundred of their classmates together to march for a range of peace-themed causes. But once it was on Facebook, organizer Baku Mertens says the event took on a life of its own. Suddenly, he and his friends were the link between some 70 NGOs on issues ranging from climate change to pension reform to women's rights. Mertens says people who've never been socially engaged before contacted him to say Trump's policies, plus fears European leaders are heading in similar directions, compelled them to come out into the streets. Mertens says Trump is both a curse and somewhat of a blessing for human rights activists.
He's really doing bad stuff, for example, for women, for migrants, for gay people, for the environment, for social security and so on. In those bad situations where we have to use his divisive discourse and his controversial discourse to build a new discourse, to build a new society. So it brings people together against his policies. It brings people together from all kinds of social movements. And that's really interesting to see. And we have to use that. And that's what we are doing here in Brussels.
Official estimates counted more than 6,000 marchers. Among them, a huge range of issues and virtually every demographic were represented. 10-year-old Inka Spanigal was with her family, all wearing Stop Trump, Save the Planet stickers. I asked Inka and her 7-year-old brother Sydney why they felt so strongly.
I'm 10 and I don't like he hates women. And he wants to build a wall in Mexico.
What are you worried about?
That he does more bad stuff.
Their mother, Yitz Gason, said it was a good learning experience.
I also want him to understand that there's lots of people who feel the same way we do, and that stuff like this shouldn't be happening without protest.
Iverna McGowan, the head of Amnesty International's EU office, explained that her organization chose to dress 100 marchers as statues of liberty in the hopes that, as a New Yorker, Trump would be impressed by the vision and therefore more amenable to their message.
It was initially a gift from Europe to the United States. Even the poem that's embedded on the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses," that actually symbolizes a United States founding values and, of course, what the founding values of international human rights are, to stand up for the needy, the poor, the vulnerable, and to believe in the rule of law and justice. So we find that this is very powerful and very symbolic in that way to remind President Trump of what the United States is founded on and what it should stand for, standing up for international values. So
then, and we have on the website, there will also be a form where people can write in messages. That will send
earlier out. In the week, Tanya Golert, co-founder of the Lights for Rights Women's Rights Group, gathered together supporters to make the protest more personal for heads of state and government who would be visiting NATO. Golert wanted to send more than a message to all those leaders in attendance. So her group sent them each one of the pink knitted hats that have come to represent anti-Trump, pro-women sentiment, along with a handwritten note.
Security is not about just about weapons, but human security as well, and development, and the idea of taking funding from family planning services does not help at all security situation. If you empower women and give them control over their bodies and their lives, that helps themselves, their communities, the region, and goes onward. So we need to be protecting and supporting women all over the world and not going the direction that the Trump administration is going right now.
But NATO leaders forged ahead with the steps they believe will help secure their nations. With the tragedy in Manchester casting a shadow over their meeting, they agreed to improve the ratio of financial burden sharing so the U.S. contribution isn't so disproportionately high, and they approved the alliance joining the U.S.-led Counter-Islamic State Coalition. And despite demonstrators' best efforts, Trump himself seemed unaffected by the carefully planned chaos in downtown Brussels. He sent out a tweet thanking the city for what he called the warm welcome he'd been given. Terry Schultz, Deutsche Welle, Brussels.
Now, in 2016 alone, more than 31 million people fled their homes or were displaced in their own countries. The Democratic Republic of Congo in Africa topped the list, overtaking even Syria for the highest number of new displacements in that year. And the ripple effects of these displacements are being felt in countries like Germany too. The country's capital, Berlin, in particular, has been struggling to cope with the influx of migrants. In 2015, more than a million refugees came to Germany, most fleeing war in Syria. According to an investigation by Der Spiegel magazine, 15,000 asylum seekers across the country are living in various types of emergency accommodation, and 90% of those are in Berlin. But the city has a new concept to accommodate its refugees. Temporary container housing. Lavde Wright has more.
At first glance, this container village in the east of Berlin looks bleak. White shipping containers are lined up on scrubby grass, separated by grey gravel paths. They're surrounded by a high fence, and a security guard is ready to check IDs at the entrance. A couple of boys are kicking a football around, while girls are playing with dolls in the sandy dirt. It's only later, when people return from their German classes, from school or from work, that the sparse container camp feels more like a home to a community, albeit a makeshift one. 250 refugees live here, mainly from Syria, Iraq, Iran and Afghanistan. Alan Chaiko, preparing black tea in his tiny kitchen, is one of them. He shares his container home with three other Syrians. Before moving here in January, they lived in a sports hall for more than a year.
This is my Zimmer. This is my bed.
This is my room, a cupboard, a desk. This is my bathroom.
Alan has the top bunk. It's two to a room, and each home is made up of two container bedrooms connected by a narrower strip for the kitchen and bathroom. The refugees could have to stay here for up to 3 years, while the city struggles to find them longer-term accommodation.
When we first moved here, I felt a bit shy. I didn't feel comfortable here. But when I got to know the people working here, they were so nice and helped us a lot. Like when we received letters, they explained everything. I've got used to living here now, but it's a bit far from the city center. I can't live here for 3 years.
Finding a flat in Berlin is difficult. The city is going through a housing crisis at a time when more and more people are moving here. Sascha Langenbach from Berlin's State Office for Refugee Affairs admits the containers aren't ideal, but he says they're a huge improvement.
Some people who were living in the sports halls didn't even have the independence to use a light switch for a year. Here, at least, they're able to close the door behind them and, for example, do their German homework. That's extremely difficult if you're living in a sports hall with 200 others. Yes, of course, people were probably hoping for something better, but we don't have that at the moment. For now, this is a step in the right direction.
22 container villages are planned for the city, and the biggest one yet is still under construction at Berlin's old Tempelhof Airport. Built by the Nazis, this airport became the site of the famous Berlin airlift during the Cold War. In 2014, 6 years after it closed, Berlin has voted in a referendum to keep the airfield as a park and against developing it for housing. That's one of the reasons why the container village here is especially controversial. Esther Witt, part of the campaign group 100% Tempelhofer Feld, is one of those against the temporary village.
It's still a mass camp for over 1,000 people, and it's still very isolated and not at all integrated into the neighbourhood. And to be doing this here on the Tempelhof airfield, which people voted to protect, it just seems like they're preparing for more permanent building work. Ultimately, it's not really helping the refugees.
It might be just a short-term solution, but it's set to cost the city 17 million euros over the next 2.5 years. After that, authorities say they'll remove the containers and return the corner of the airfield to Berliners. But people like Esther are not convinced that will happen. And even if it does, the city still faces the puzzle of where to more permanently house refugees like Alan and his roommates.
That was Lavde Wright reporting from Berlin. Africa bolo don beno Manginyan Africa bolo don beno Egal sakanai sangadani sadole We've just got time for a quick European news roundup before we leave you for another week. As part of his tour of foreign capitals, US President Donald Trump was in Brussels on Thursday to attend meetings with NATO and EU leaders. It was his first meeting at NATO headquarters since his election. Emma Wallis has the details and this roundup of European news.
Brussels is the fourth stop on President Trump's first 9-day tour abroad. The US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson told reporters flying over on Air Force One that, of course, the US supported the crucial Article 5 of NATO's charter, which pledges members to come to the defense of each other when threatened. Mr. Tillerson underlined that the US was just keen to make sure that the 28 member nations, plus soon to join Montenegro, maintained pledges that they had already made to contribute at least 2% to the defense budget of the pact by 2024. The US is already contributing 4%, and to date, only the UK, Greece, Estonia, and Poland are paying the required amounts. The American delegation will be pushing for NATO to join the 68-member US-led coalition fighting Islamic State. However, on Wednesday, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said this would be symbolic because it is absolutely out of the question for NATO to actively engage in combat operations. A month-long political crisis in the Czech Republic came to an end on Wednesday when the president replaced the finance minister, Andrej Babiš. Babiš himself suggested his replacement in order to end a political spat with the prime minister, Bohuslav Sobotka. Mr. Babiš's party, the populist centrist ANO, is expected to win elections in October and is currently in a government coalition with the prime minister's Social Democratic Party. Mr. Babiš is the second richest man in the Czech Republic. The row started when the Prime Minister accused Mr. Babiš of avoiding tax by purchasing tax-free bonds for his chemicals and food conglomerate. Babiš placed his company in a trust earlier this year in order to comply with a new conflict of interest law. He owns several media companies too and has also been put under pressure over leaked recorded conversations which purport to show him pressuring a journalist to attack his rivals. Babiš denies both allegations. Spanish authorities, including the Catholic Church and the Ministry of Health, have agreed to open up their archives to parents who believe their children may have been stolen at birth. The announcement came after a British MEP took up the case of a British woman who gave birth to a girl in 1992 and was told her daughter had died within hours of being born. The British woman, Ruth Appleby, said the meeting felt like a bit of a turning point and that real progress was being made for the first time. The woman became suspicious in 2010 after she bought over her baby's remains for burial in Britain and found the skeleton in the coffin to be of a much older infant than a newborn. Her case was referred to the Spanish authorities, but she was unhappy with their handling of the case and began to petition the European Parliament. It's been estimated that as many as 300,000 children could have been stolen in a practice which began in the late 1930s under the fascist dictator General Francisco Franco. Nuns, priests, nurses, and doctors have all been implicated in the mass theft and trafficking of the infants, and there are several organizations in Spain dedicated to returning stolen babies to their birth parents.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Spotlight on Europe. We hope you have enjoyed the show and we would love to hear your response in an email via feedback.africa@deutschewelle.com. We are live on Facebook. Our address is Deutsche Welle Africa. Thanks to the rest of the team, Helen Sini, Emma Wallis and our technician, Christoph Gruver. And thank you for tuning in as well. We will be back next week with another edition of Spotlight on Europe. I'm Zipporah Nyambura. From all of us here at Deutsche Welle, have a wonderful week ahead.